Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more door for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's January the 10th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. To start us off this week, I got an email from a comrade called Roy in Australia. Now, Roy asks, Harold, could you please refrain from any quotes or references to Lenin? No, Roy, sorry, I can't. We're trying to foment a revolution here, and it's something that white people just plain don't know how to do, at least not this generation of white people. And one of the greatest and most significant events in the past century was the Russian Revolution of 1917, and we need to study it and learn how the Bolsheviks did it, because they won. Just like we need to be studying Castro and the Provisional IRA, because they won. And yes, the IRA did more or less win, in that they forced the British to buy them off with government jobs, or at least buy their leaders off with government jobs. It's possible to study and appreciate communists as revolutionaries without embracing their ideology. Now, we need to quit worrying about purity and start worrying about victory, or else the whole issue will be moot because there won't be any white people left to save. Now, if there's anybody out there who's dumb enough to think that I'm some kind of communist because I occasionally talk about successful red revolutionaries like Lenin and Che Guevara and the Provos in Ireland, well, looks like we all have our problem with what Rush Limbaugh calls low-information voters. And yes, as some of you know, that's my own secret perversion. I listen to Rush Limbaugh, and sometimes I quote him, and yes, I know he's a rabid Zionist. But I still listen to him, and I learn from him. And if I ever get anything like his audience, I will be able to imitate him to some degree, because his way works, at least to the limited degree that mere words of any kind work. Now, my effective audience is about 5,000 people per week. His is about 50 million. What does this tell you about being pure versus being effective? You may notice that I sometimes recommend books and Hollywood movies that have objectionable scenes in them. Now, there's no perfection to be found in Hollywood. The last perfect movie was made in 1941 in Germany. It was called Judasus. Although some of them since then have come pretty close, in my opinion, like Zulu and Miller's Crossing. But sometimes a certain limited truth or pertinent idea slips through. Certain Hollywood movies like Telephone, that I was talking about a few weeks ago, have a very definite message if you can learn to read between the lines as you watch. Now, you may have noticed also that I have no hesitation about outright stealing stuff from the Reds if it's good or useful for our purposes, hence my doing things like playing Jefferson Airplane's Volunteers and some of that IRA stuff on here. As far as I'm concerned, if I can use anything to advance the 14 words, I will use it, and I don't care where it comes from. I generally have a rule about no outright nigger material on here, but I even let that one slip once with that Richard Pryor cut last year, which enabled me to dance and piss on Rodney King's grave. Now, it's true that Hitler and Mussolini staged their revolutions through uniformed mass movements in the streets because the times were right and because they had white populations who were capable of responding to those tactics and who were, in fact, willing to do so. We do not. We are dealing with Beavis and Butthead and Homer Simpson and Comic Book Guy and Barney Gumble. Therefore, we have to look to other historical parallels for instruction, and many of those are communist. Communist ideology may be screwed up, but they are still capable of producing genuinely hard men of the kind we have to have. We have to figure out how to get from our people the same kind of fanatical devotion that they show to their causes. Some of the books on the party's recommended reading list are by leftist writers, even Jews like Barbara Tuchman, or outright Reds like Che Guevara and Alberto Bayo. Anyone who is unwilling to learn from the enemy is an idiot, and anyone who refuses to assess an enemy's strengths and weaknesses calmly and rationally is going to lose to opponents who still remember how to think rather than to feel. We have to win this time, people, because if we lose, we and our civilization will no longer be here on the earth, as in no more white people, as in the world as one big jungle and eventually one big anthill as the Chinese exterminate the blacks and mestizos like we never had the balls to do. We have to win. Lenin and Castro and the Provos won. We have to quit moaning and bitching about ideological purity and start winning. I suppose it's all about to what degree we are willing to compromise. We all have our lines that we won't cross, and with me, it's tolerating buggery and allying ourselves with Jews and non-whites in any way. Those are my red lines. Accepting non-whites among us in even the smallest fraction is the thin edge of the wedge. The same thing with accepting homosexuals. We have to create a world that is 100% white and 100% sane. No exceptions, no honorary Aryans, no nudge-nudge wink-wink. No shades of gray, because the gray is where the Jew has learned to hide and where he lurks to do harm. But learning from Jews, learning from communists, and where expedient imitating them, so that our brave new world is the one that comes into being and not theirs? That's legitimate in my eyes, and it doesn't bother me a bit. We have to start winning again. Their ways work. Ours do not, because our people are no longer capable of responding in the way that we want them to. We have to adapt. Moving right along here, I've gotten several emails complaining about the overall tone of my podcast last week. And okay, I admit it was a bit ranty and ravey, even by my standards. But from now on, they're going to mostly be like that. And also, I got emails from people scolding me because I'm discussing things in public that I shouldn't be discussing because of who we know is listening to these casts. Now, there is a certain validity to these concerns. Yes, I know who's listening, and some of them are, in fact, trained intelligence analysts whose job is to drain every last bit of information they can from every word I say, and so it behooves me to guard my tongue. Yes, I am aware of the risks involved to me personally and to anyone associated with me, or with this podcast, or with my work. Although, again, I have to point out that a lot of the paranoia we feel about the dictator's secret police is deliberately generated and encouraged by the secret police themselves as a kind of institutional terrorism to prevent white Americans from accessing and using their legal and constitutional rights, especially the rights of free speech, freedom of conscience, and freedom of association. Now, all that having been said, yes, it is very possible that over the coming months I will be discussing some things that might provide useful intelligence to the enemy, and which probably don't need to be overheard by outsiders for a variety of reasons. So, why am I doing it? I'm doing it because while the enemy may not need to hear some of these things, you do. And Radio Free Northwest is my main medium of communication. Now, that measly 5,000 hits per week may be chicken feed by internet standards, but the fact is that it's one of the largest audiences in our incredibly tiny little movement. And the bulk of you listening to this are basically sincere, if somewhat confused, people whom I have to reach, whom I have to instruct, to whom I have to try to impart certain knowledge and certain skills and certain approaches to the whole problem of racial politics and racial survival. Yes, the police and the FBI monitors and the spies from the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center and the brown Asiatic homosexuals in Vancouver and the freaked out morons from that 90s show don't need to be hearing this, but you do. And the price we're going to pay for you hearing what you should hear is that some of them hear some things that they shouldn't. Again, all that having been said, now I have to swing back onto the side of caution. I understand that I have to pick and choose and word very carefully everything I say on here for the next few months, especially with a view toward making sure that you guys who I'm really talking to out there get what I'm saying, and as much as possible, the bad people who are listening don't. Now, that's going to be hard. At times, you're going to think I'm rambling on and on about nothing. And at times, the things I'm saying are going to sound maddeningly obscure. At times, you're not going to have any idea what the hell I'm on about. Just remember that I'm having to walk a kind of tightrope here so that I can impart as much information and content to you as I can, while simultaneously withholding as much as I can from the human detritus who are listening to me in order to try and figure out some way to force me to be silent. And they may succeed, by the way. We have to remember that we now live in a one-party dictatorship, and that over the past 4 years we've seen men like Bill White go to prison for posting to the internet information which was a matter of public record. Johnny Logan Spencer going to prison for posting a poem on the internet which was critical of the dictator. And Edgar Steele being victimized by audio tapes fabricated by FBI technicians and perjury on the witness stand by FBI agents. In effect, the Constitution of the United States is no longer in force. And clearly political speech, which was hitherto protected by the First Amendment, has now been criminalized. Not only that, but what with Guantanamo Bay and extraordinary rendition and the loss of access to the courts, they're not even bothering with trials before corrupt Edgar Steele-type judges anymore. American citizens can now simply disappear, quite legally, and for all we know, they are. One of the things I'm going to be advocating over the coming months is a kind of check-in system among white nationalists so that basically we will know it when somebody disappears. I think that's the next step. Certain people we know and whom we're used to hearing from, certain websites, they're simply going to start vanishing. And anyone trying to find out what's going on will meet with a wall of silence. Okay, time for some of that obscure movement talk I just referred to. Now, down through the years, we in our little movement have acquired the habit of doing things in certain ways, because we've found, through long experience, that these same old tactics and practices are the only ways in which we can generate even a tiny, tiny bit of help and response from the people we're supposed to be fighting for. I put this another way. The entire art and science of white nationalism boils down to us fearless leader types desperately, frantically trying to get you to respond, and to respond with something besides words. To get you to respond with some kind of physical act in the real world that will in some way move the cause of the 14 words an inch or two closer to a white homeland. Now, leaving aside for the moment the questionable quality of so many of our past fearless leaders, at our best, that's our holy grail. To get some kind of actual, physical, real-world response from you, other than words. Now, the usual response that all too many of us look for is a financial contribution, to be sure, and that definitely qualifies as something tangible. I'll be talking about money as a separate subject later on in this podcast, but you get the idea. Now, this has gotten harder and harder since the internet came along, because the internet is nothing but the endless generation of words, written words, spoken words like this podcast, and electronic images as well. Okay, if we can ever develop the internet as a genuine mass medium for white nationalism, that'll be great. But right now, our combined readership and viewership and listenership on the internet is so small that we're completely ineffective. And in any case, internet is a form of activity with the same essential goal, to get you to respond in some physical way off the internet, out in the real world, where you have to rise from the seated position, put on your shoes and your coat, go out your door into the cold and the wind and the rain that exists outside the warm room where your computer is, and maybe get in your car and drive someplace to meet another real live human being. Or better yet, to physically distribute paper literature so that other white people have some kind of personal physical contact with the Northwest Movement, a leaflet or a business card or a sticker, something that they can touch and hold in their hand and which has existence outside of an electronic screen, something which gives them a physical link to an actual person, a real live white nationalist, not a computer image or a web link, but a human being. What I'm getting at here is that the purpose of all this activity on the internet and the computer, including this very podcast, is to try and get you away from the computer, get you to stand up and go outside and do something that involves interacting with human beings. I cannot do this for you. Whether I like it or not, my duty station is indeed mostly behind this computer because I have no staff and we have no GHQ unit. Now, it shouldn't be like that. I should be in possession of a functioning motor vehicle, hopefully a little more late model than my present 14-year-old golf cart. I should have a reliable staff or team of assistants whom I can leave behind at our general headquarters to hold down the fort while I and at least one other aide roll all over the Pacific Northwest, meeting people, visiting people, talking to groups, doing media appearances and interviews. Now, that situation does not pertain at the present moment because you have not decided that it's what you want. If it was what you wanted, you would presumably have done something about it by now. I hope that one day you guys will decide that something of the kind is what you want. Frankly, I'm tired of spending my days chained to this computer like a galley slave because there's no one else to help, but that's not my call. Now, what I need for you guys to start wrapping your minds around here is this. I am indeed willing to do this job for you within the limits imposed by my age and my health for as long as the dictatorship still tolerates my activities. Yeah, I know that's a lot of caveats, but what are you going to do? I'm almost 60 and I'm opposing a regime led by a stupid and egomaniacal nigger. Common sense should tell you that I need certain resources in order to do this. And no, I'm not just talking about money. We'll get into all this in the coming months. But for now, let's just state the obvious. You will either decide to provide me with these resources or you won't. Now, getting back to what I was mumbling about a few minutes ago, what I do not want to see happen is for us to fall back into the bad old days and the bad old ways simply through lack of imagination. In the past, virtually every time we've tried to start something up, we have reverted to type. Everything from membership cards to little 8 and 10 man so-called rallies wearing costumes because we just can't seem to figure out anything else that works, and by that I mean anything else that gets even a tiny, twitchy response from the pale American blobs. Now, with the internet, the blob seems to have gone almost completely dead. It's sitting there staring at a screen with a mouse in its hand. This is our challenge. We are stuck with the internet, like gunpowder and atomic power. It's here, and it can't be uninvented, and we are who we are, who the 21st century has made us into. What we have to do is to find the magic beans that will translate words on the internet into physical action in the real world. Now, if we can't do that, then there's no point to any of this. And rather than spend the next 20 years doing nothing but playing with our computers, we might all just as well crawl off into the bathtub and slit our wrists like the ancient Romans used to do. Now, I'm sorry to say that there are some among us who would genuinely prefer that than to exerting any effort which might involve risk and inconvenience. I'm not one of them. Okay, time for a music break. I've played a lot of Southern and Appalachian folk music on this show in the past, but this week I think I'll focus on actual country music as such. In honor of Dianne Feinstein and her gun control bill, I was going to play Saturday Night Special, which I don't consider to be so much an anti-gun song as a Skynyrd song, but while I would get it, I know a lot of our listeners wouldn't, and one thing about the movement, you never know how people are going to take things. Always remember, we're not allowed to have a sense of humor. So, anyway, here's a gun song from Waylon Jennings instead. Thing I ever had seen. So I asked if I could have one Sunday when I grew up. Mama dropped a dozen eggs. She really blew up. Yes, she really blew up. She didn't understand. I
gonna set the pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The very first pistol was a cap and ball coat. Shoot as fast as lightning, but it moves a mile slow. It moves a mile slow. Soon I found out it'll get you into trouble, but it can't get you out. About a year later, got a Colt 45. Called a peacemaker, but I never knew why. I never knew why. I didn't understand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. Got into a card game in a Cumberland town. Caught a minor cheating, so I shot the dog down. Watched a man fall. Never touched his holster. Never had a chance to roll. Trials in the morning, then they brought me out of bed. Ask me how I made it. Not guilty, I said. Not guilty, I said. You got the wrong man. Left him touch the trigger, but the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Nothing touched the trigger, but the devil's right hand.
Comrades, today I would like to talk to you about a fascinating author by the name of Savitri Devi. Savitri Devi was born in France, but she's part Greek, part Italian, and part English. At a very early age, she develops a fascination with Aryan religion. Eventually, she goes to India in order to experience a continual practice of Aryan heathenry. And she's written several books. So far, I've only read two of them, one of them Lightning on, and the other Gold in the Furnace. And I would like to talk to you today about both. Savitri's belief system is one that you could find in ancient Greece, but you could also find in India, and that is she believes in four ages of the world. And this age of the world, if you would talk to most Brahmins with really very little disagreement, they would tell you that we're living in the Kali Yuga, which is the last age of the world. And the way you can tell that we're living in the Kali Yuga is that we're living at a time when cosmic order is overturned and in disarray. So Savitri sees Hitler as a intercessory who comes to help restore cosmic order to the world. So she really sees him as a type of avatorial figure, even if not a liturgically accepted avatar, as one might find if one goes to a temple and they would talk about Rama or Krishna or Kalki. But she definitely sees him as a man against time in any case, and therefore sees him as a savior. And she really believes that because cosmic order is an eternal principle, that National Socialism is an ideology that at the end of the day is undefeatable. Yet she conceives that the Kali Yuga is a time in which, because order is on the decline, that it's possible that it could have a temporary defeat. So in 1948, she goes to Germany with the Ram Gopal Dance Company, and she distributes handwritten leaflets in order to encourage the German people to remain faithful to the National Socialist ideology. One thing that is very sad about her story in Goldrinus is that she never goes to Europe during the blossom of the Third Reich, and she never gets to meet Hitler. And it's very sad and honestly also mysterious, because Vitry really doesn't know why she doesn't go. She does have a bit of an excuse in that the ship that she was supposed to sail on, the voyage was canceled because Italy changes sides. But even then, the question is, why didn't she go to Germany sooner? Even her husband advises her to go to Hitler. He tells her that his conception of life is very much similar to Savitri's, and therefore that she should meet with Hitler. But she tarries in India, and she goes to temples, she makes sacrifices, she prays for the triumph of Germany, but it's very odd, I think, that she never actually goes to Germany until 1948. But while she's in Germany, she distributes leaflets, and eventually she is caught and goes to prison for 3 years. But before serving her sentence, she meets many Germans who are sympathetic to her and has many wonderful conversations with them, which she records in Gold in the Furnace, much of which she wrote when she was in prison. She is happy to go to prison because she wants to participate in some small way in the martyrdom that other National Socialists have participated in. Eventually, after this trip to Germany, I believe that she returns to India, but she does a lot of traveling after that. She winds up living alone, and she winds up having many cats, so she becomes one of those cat ladies. But she also joined something called the World Union of National Socialists, and she becomes friendly with Rockwell and also with William Pierce, who is actually the editor of Lightning and the Sun. So she's really heavily involved in the movement throughout her life, and I really hope that you take the time to read some of her book. So thank you for listening.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who was inserted into Steele's home, posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family, until he saw the opportunity to help the Bureau destroy an outspoken critic of the regime. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. Now, these conversations appear, even to a layman who first hears them, to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts, who were prepared to state categorically, for the record, that the tapes were fraudulent, were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to try and keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. In September 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years for fraud, so there's some comfort in hoping that the bent brief may die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. Interestingly enough, McAllister himself was a former United States attorney and prosecutor, which gives you some idea of the typical moral character of the people in the federal judiciary. For whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed somebody off really bad, although I don't see how. Ed had announced plans to run for governor of Idaho, but he subsequently withdrew from the governor's race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is being held, we think, in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. No one has, in fact, personally heard from Edgar Steele in almost 6 months now. His mail has been simply disappearing without response, and recently my own mail to Edgar started to be returned to me marked undeliverable as addressed. Since the triple-checked address and email is precisely the one listed on the Bureau of Prisons website for inmates, there is obviously something bad going on here. There's no way to tell what's happened to Ed. He may be in solitary, he may be in the infirmary, he may have been secretly moved to another prison, or he may be dead from his heart condition or because the dictatorship simply murdered him in his cell one night. We have no way of knowing. I have also had Cindy Steele's present situation explained to me, and it's pretty damn vile, and it makes me even more ashamed than usual to be an American, if that's possible. But given the movement's habit of shooting the messenger, I don't think I should be the first one to come out with this horror story. I hope that she will. I'm now going to play for you the second part of a podcast that Edgar Steele made in February of 2008, not 2007 like it says on the audio, as you can tell from Ed's reference to the 2008 election.
2 years ago, we thought we elected a mostly new Congress that would end the war in Iraq. Instead, we got a batch of all-new morons who fell all over themselves in getting in line with Speaker Pelosi leading the charge by firmly announcing that impeachment of Bush was off the table. Congress finally became altogether irrelevant in the face of unchallenged executive orders, not to mention signing statements and various other pronouncements by the president that the law does not apply to the executive branch. Today, wars are started and treaties negotiated without congressional oversight. as with the current Iraqi war and concomitant Iraqi long-term protection treaty. Suddenly, under the ATS Advanced Passenger Information System, we need permission from Homeland Security's Secretary Chertoff to leave or re-enter America. Though our passports are in order, and we have received valid visas from foreign destinations. This often is done covertly, while you await the boarding call for your jet to wherever. Did you know that Chertoff, like all the American Jews in power today, possesses dual citizenship, both American and Israeli? Dual citizenship that is denied to all other Americans? Non-citizens routinely are denied admission to America. Now Chertoff has mandated a national ID card simply to enter courthouses and airports. In a particularly telling move, Chertoff hired the old head of Russia's KGB to head up Homeland Security's department that keeps track of those of us who attend whatever they deem to be anti-government rallies and meetings, like Ron Paul meetup groups, for example. Warrantless searches, both physical and informational, are the order of the day. Not that it matters any longer, with the judges firmly in the pocket of the executive branch. Strip searches of citizens taken into custody for misdemeanors or less are becoming common. Torture, even of American citizens, if branded domestic terrorists, is deemed acceptable by the judiciary and desirable, believe it or not, by the general citizenry. Not only has the right to demand a court hearing when taken into custody disappeared, thereby overruling the centuries-old habeas corpus doctrine, but even the right simply to petition the government has been eliminated from the Constitution. Travel with more than a couple $1,000 and it will be seized if found, and you will pay hell in getting it back. We're familiar with this scenario, of course. Now, even your home cash, gold, silver, and food stash is in danger when found by authorities, who may legally assume it is theirs unless you can prove that you earned it. Here's the logical extension. Can you prove your wife's wedding ring is yours? Can you prove much of anything you possess is yours? Again, there are links to articles sprinkled throughout to today's piece, and that business about proving something that you own that's in your home is yours being necessary to keep the police from stealing it from you is one of them. Local police departments hopped up on delusions of Rambo-like grandeur increasingly think in military terms and act accordingly. The 2008 Defense Authorization Bill actually directs and funds the integration of local police with federal military forces. More Americans now are in jail than citizens of all other countries are being held in jails combined. Just think about that single fact for a moment. Everybody in jail throughout the world except in America added up. There are fewer people in those jails than are now sitting in American jail cells, total. State National Guard units have been co-opted by the president and sent to Iraq to die. And the foregoing simply are some of the significant changes of just this past year. Recounting the full panoply of civil liberty infringement during the current Bush regime would take the rest of the day. What does all this mean? Since the Bush regime seized power in America for the simple act of writing the very article you are reading right now, current unchallenged law provides that my home can be secretly searched and all my communications secretly monitored without warrants. My home can be broken into in the dead of night, and I can be dragged out and held indefinitely. And that means permanently, without being charged. I can be strip searched and beaten, all without anybody being told my whereabouts, without access to an attorney, without ever being given a court hearing. And then I can be shipped out of the country to be tortured, and I can be tried by a military tribunal and summarily executed. Seriously, I just have to be named an enemy combatant, which now includes political dissidents. And I only have to be named that by some faceless bureaucrat. If you're reading this article, along with listening to it, pause the audio right now and go read it again, the one that I just gave you, slowly. And allow it to sink in. Is all that likely to happen to me? Well, not this week perhaps, but the laws, procedures, and infrastructure are in place now. And it is happening to some American citizens. Imagine the boy in the video at the link that I give you in the online version of this piece today as being your son. A young man harassed by a police officer. It's not hard to do. Have you ever personally encountered or witnessed a cop with an attitude like this? Seriously, go watch that short YouTube video. It's important. I've seen lots of cops like this. Therefore, I must conclude that almost everybody has. And by the way, the cop in that video merely ended up suspended with pay for a time. Consider just how close to the edge we are in America. And then watch two other videos that I also give you the links for in the online version of today's piece. Two videos of our police in action today, and in both, defenseless white guys in wheelchairs and in custody are physically abused by black police officers. Why? Because they can. That's why. It's the way that blacks treat whites when they feel they can get away with it, particularly when they are given official authority. And you say that you want to make one of them your president? This is your America today. It's coming. Soon. And in your lifetime. Like it or not. By now, followers of my rants understand that price inflation, which clearly is running over 10% per year, who you gonna believe? Asked Swirly Ben Bernanke. Me? Or your own lying eyes? They want us to believe that price inflation is only 2 or 3%, but you know better. You know that it follows monetary inflation. It's a symptom of monetary inflation, and it's running well over 10%. It happens because the foxes, whom we put in charge of our hen house, are busy gorging themselves on our chickens. They simply print money, whether on paper or electrons. Debit cash, credit debt, our debt, their cash. When they started to get really out of control with their money creation scheme, which is a crime called counterfeiting, if you or I do it, they simply stopped telling us about how much money they were creating. M3, the most useful measure of the money supply, is what they particularly wanted to keep from us, but you can get a private assessment of this key figure, which is running 18% today, at the link in the online version of today's article at this stage. And today, they claim that inflation is running only 2 to 3%. Who are you going to believe, them or your own lying eyes? Inflation, housing, jobs, debt trade deficit, they all are much worse than they tell you. So naturally, what's the government going to do about it? Stop telling us, of course. The national debt keeps growing, fueled by that insane war in the Middle East. What's going to cut it? We don't have any manufacturing base left in America. We don't have anything that foreigners are interested in trading for. Those interest rate cuts that you keep hearing about, they help the bankers, not us. You won't see them. They keep the banks from going under where they belong. Market manipulation saves them, not us.
Since we're doing country music this week, here's one of those good old country songs that you only play on Sunday. You know, one of the kind they used to take their hats off when they played it on Grand Ole Opry. This one will really cheer you up. This is Wayne Scott.
Did you say it was, brother? Who was it fell by the way? When whiskey and blood run together, did you hear anyone pray? I didn't hear nobody pray, dear brother. I didn't hear nobody pray. I heard the crash on the highway, but I didn't hear nobody pray. When I heard the crash on the highway, I knew what it was from the start. I went to the scene of destruction. A picture was stamped on my heart. There was whiskey and blood all together. with glass where they lay. Death laid her hand in destruction, but I didn't hear nobody pray. I didn't hear nobody pray, dear brother. I didn't hear nobody pray. I heard the crash on the highway, but I didn't hear nobody pray. Wish I could change this sad story that I am now telling you, but there is no way I can change it, for somebody's life is now through. Her soul has been called by the master. They died in the crash on the way. I heard the groans of the dying, but I didn't hear nobody pray. I didn't hear nobody pray, dear brother. I didn't hear nobody pray. I heard the crash on the highway, but I didn't hear nobody pray. On the highway, but I didn't hear nobody pray.
I'm going to talk to you now about something I've spoken of before on here, and some people at the time thought I spoke too much of it. On the other hand, maybe I spoke too little, I don't know. It's a topic that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable, including me to some extent, because it's something we in the movement very seldom sit down and talk about rationally and clear-headedly. I refer to the relationship between politics, all politics, including ours, and money. I refer to the fact that from now on, I'm going to have to spend a large part of my time raising money for the Northwest Front, and I understand that this is going to cause some difficulties in the way in which I am perceived and the way in which we operate. But given the fact that the electoral process was proven on November the 6th to be absolutely useless, as if the point ever needed any proving, how can we possibly bring about change in the world? I've said this before. Let me say it again to make sure that this is sinking in. There are two ways to create change in the modern world. We can use money, or we can use a gun. We do not have the physical courage to use the gun yet, or the competency to use it effectively if we did. Going berserk and shooting up a shopping mall or gunning down little niglets in a kindergarten just because you're so angry you explode serves no purpose whatsoever. That's not a political act, it's a psychiatric one. Now, if you do that shit, in fact, it makes our job immensely harder. It's incredibly counterproductive. Please do not do anything of the kind. No, really, don't do it. This is not just Harold covering his ass. Don't do that crazy shit. I do not want you to die for the Northwest homeland. I want you to live for the homeland, and what's even worse, I want you to work for it. And that's going to take some real guts. Now, that means that we have to use money to create the change that we want, at least at first, until circumstances evolve and until we can correct our character problem and become white men again instead of merely white males. We must have money to finance the kind of revolutionary movement in the Northwest for the first few years of existence that we need while we're preparing the ground. I know that this is a bitter pill, but we need to swallow and internalize it. Just like every other kind of politics in the Western world, a large part of what we accomplish is going to be dependent on our ability to raise money. Okay, let's talk about money now for a while. By the way, this is not a fund appeal, it's just what I said. It's a discussion about the money problem. Now, every time I talk about this, I get these whines from goat dancers and internet Jews and so on that Harold is a con man. You're a con man, Harold. No, actually, I'm not. In point of historical fact, I am one of the very few prominent movement personalities who has never been a con man. And that's what has generated most of the bullshit that you read about me on the internet. The movement has, in fact, been riddled with frauds and thieves and liars in leadership positions who don't appreciate the fact that there has always been one honest man among them who will call them out. But, of course, that segues into the dark, forbidden territory of names and dates and long and shameful backstory, and the details of specific incidents as to who did what, when, why, and to whom. The 1990s especially is replete with ghastly examples of this kind of nonequitur. In our wisdom as a community, we have placed our own past beyond the bounds of discussion, and in a sense, I have to agree. It's probably best that it remain there. We really are running out of time now, and we have to at least attempt to do the job we've been claiming to do for the past six decades. We just don't have time for the endless postmortems. So, no, just to be clear, I'm not asking for money. This is not a fund appeal. I am discussing the subject of movement funding, or lack of it. Now, do you get the difference? Okay. Historically, white nationalist racial groups of any kind have always been woefully and tragically underfunded. Now, this is one of the many reasons that we haven't been able to get anywhere over the past 60 years, although only one of many. Another reason is dishonesty, incompetence, and financial skullduggery in the leadership with regard to what funds such groups have been able to raise. When we do get hold of some money, we never seem to know what to do with it. But that's another discussion to be postponed until such time as we're ready to confront our past in detail. Moving right along here, there are two quote-unquote legitimate ways of raising money for white nationalist groups. The two methods I refer to are direct donation and number two, selling stuff, i.e. books, newspapers, publications, CDs and videotapes, DVDs, and a whole range of racial paraphernalia ranging from flags, bumper stickers, baseball caps, iron-on patches, pens, t-shirts, coffee mugs, everything from imitation Third Reich medals to Ku Klux Klan garden gnomes. Yes, really. These are what Gerhard Lauck used to refer to as toys. There are a few other ways that white groups have tried down through the years to raise funds. None of them have been very successful. Every so often, somebody comes up with the original, they think, idea of starting so-called legitimate businesses to fund the movement. I am not aware of any instance in the past 40 years where this has been successfully done. Usually because the so-called business isn't a real business, that is. It's usually some kind of multi-level marketing or pyramid scheme, and it doesn't actually produce anything or provide any legitimate goods and services. Now, any business which does have an actual economic purpose invariably requires full-time attention and 70-hour work weeks from the people involved, which is the only way that any small business can survive and show a profit in modern America, surrounded and hedged in as small enterprise is by huge corporate competition and government regulation. Now, people who attempt this strategy either end up packing in the racial angle to keep the business going, or more often packing in the business when they find that it requires actual work in copious amounts, and they don't have any time left for their white nationalist hobby. As with everything else, when the going gets rough, the white boys quit and wander away. Now, the one time I can think of where this was ever actually seriously attempted was by the late Rick Cooper. For a couple of years in the 1980s, Rick ran a carpet cleaning franchise called ST Enterprises out of his home in Goldendale, Washington, and he employed a couple of his old buddies from the Tracy, California NSWPP unit to shampoo carpets with rented equipment. It eventually folded when the guys lost interest, or else they spatted with Cooper and wandered away, which is the way a lot of movement stories end. Now, for the rest of his life, Cooper supported the quarterly NS Vanguard newsletter through commuting from Goldendale to a medical records transcriptionist job in Portland. As is so often the case, one man's paycheck was the source for 90% of NS Vanguard's funds. We get that a lot, and we have to get away from it and move into real politics, not one-man hobbies. Another occasional source of money for racialist groups, sometimes even serious money, has been inheritance. Now, a large part of the white nationalist audience has always been elderly, since only when white people get old do they appear to wake up and notice what's going on around them. Usually, they finally start to pay attention when the system starts to victimize them in various ways and steal their savings. I may have mentioned this before, but it seems to take all of us pale people an awful long time to learn wisdom. We got some really great codgers and middle-aged people associated with the movement, but you have to wonder, where the hell were these people when they were in their teens and their 20s? What were they doing, and why did no one approach them back then? Now, this can't be a geriatric revolution where we try to storm the barricades in our wheelchairs and our walkers. Somehow or other, we have got to start getting through to young men and women in their teens and 20s. Sorry, where was I? Oh, yeah, okay, money. Now, as I've said before, middle-aged to elderly white people are one of the last demographics in America with any remaining private wealth which we have any chance of accessing. Certain groups and fearless leaders, whom, in deference to the Prime Directive I will not name, periodically used to run little ads in their publications to the effect of, remember our group in your will, and some of them still do. Every now and then, some old person would die and leave a significant bequest to someone racial. This has led in the past to a number of extended court cases, such as the big lawsuit between Cardo and the old IHR about that multi-million dollar legacy from the elderly Swiss lady, and one that I'm personally familiar with, the Richard Cotter Ernst Zundel affair. Now, the reason I'm familiar with it is that I knew Dick Cotter back in the day, and he might have decided to leave his fortune to me, but I ended up having to go on the run for 5 years in Ireland, so I wasn't around when he died, and he left around $600,000, I think it was, something like that, to Ernst Zundel, who never saw a penny of it. What happened then is what usually happens in these cases. Cotter's non-racist, left-liberal, trashed-out, druggy kids contested the will in court. So, as per usual, the lawyers ended up getting all the money. It's kind of like Jarndyce versus Jarndyce in Charles Dickens' Bleak House. As I recall, there was also some kind of skullduggery when the ADL got involved, and they basically paid a lump sum to Cotter's children so that they wouldn't settle before all the money ran out. And the Jews picked up all the attorney's fees until they ran the case into the ground and made sure that Zundel never got a dime of it because the legacy was depleted by legal fees and general legal corruption. I'm tempted to say that the Northwest Front will probably not ever have to face a situation like this, if only because we don't have anybody on our list who's wealthy enough to leave anything. But that may change. One of the marks of a serious political movement is that people with money and power realize that such a movement has a chance to win, and if nothing else, they'd better start hedging their bets. So, at some point, we might have some supporters who will die and leave us large legacies, and we need to be legally prepared for that. The problem is that kind of legal preparation, in the form of trusts and tax-free foundations and all the other tricks that the liberal NGOs use, also require money to set up. Now, the old National Alliance under Dr. William Pierce was probably the most efficient example or business model of the traditional movement meld, in which direct donation was combined with selling stuff. Now, at one stage around 2001 or so, Pierce was supposedly taking in $1 million-plus per year, a good portion, if not the majority, of his boodle coming from the sale of skinhead and satanic rock CDs through Resistance Records. Now, I personally don't believe that any white nationalist group has any business dabbling in or profiting from Satanism. There are two things with which our movement can never be in any way publicly associated in people's minds: homosexuality and violent obsessive anti-Christianity. Now, obviously, the good doctor disagreed, and since he died on his own 330-acre rural estate, surrounded by paid staff and infrastructure of the kind I'd sell my soul for, who knows? Maybe he was right. I will never compromise like that, but let's face it, compromise can pay the bills, and you can't keep yourself warm in the winter under a bridge by wrapping oneself in principles. Pierce also used formal organization, which is a discussion we've been batting around in the front for a while, about the one thing that can be said in favor of structured formalism is that it allows a group to demand regular monthly dues, usually in the neighborhood of $10 per month. Now, this makes possible something that I have never been able to do, i.e. it allows for fearless leader actually to plan and project a budget, those few of us who ever knew how to do so. I can never really promise or commit myself to any major project because I have no idea how much money I'll have coming in from month to month. Now, I've told you guys before, I'm like a waiter that you tip or a busker playing his guitar outside a subway station or in the park waiting for people to throw coins into his open guitar case on the ground. Like Blanche DuBois, I am dependent on the kindness of strangers. Now, so far, you guys have kept me out from under the bridge. But we can't run an actual revolutionary political movement like that. But for reasons that I've already gone into in the White Book and elsewhere, we can't use formal organization. The first reason is external security. And with the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011, the regime has revoked the Constitution and allocated to the dictator the power to execute and indefinitely imprison American citizens without trial and make war without congressional approval. The regime will fairly soon succeed in bringing in the European concept of the illegal organization, and so somebody merely signing an application form can serve as a form of self-incrimination. Now, I know the regime and its secret police are going to do whatever the fuck they're going to do, ask Edgar Steele, but it's foolish of us to make it easy for them. That means that we can't have quote-unquote members. There can never be anything which might, by any stretch of some U.S. attorney's imagination, be described as a Northwest Front membership list. Such a document cannot exist, at least not a real one. Now, the FBI may decide to fabricate one someday, like they fabricated the Edgar Steele audio tapes, but there's nothing I can do about that. Now, another reason that we can't use any kind of formal membership system simply as a way to raise money through the regular dues is because our movement, or community, or whatever the hell you want to call this thing of ours, contains a lot of people whom we neither want nor need as quote-unquote members of the Northwest Front. And frankly, we need to be able to disclaim these people if and when they show their butts in various ways. I will never forget the few bad days I had back in 81 when John Hinckley plugged Reagan in the Secret Service found his NSPA membership card in his wallet signed by me. Also, formal membership just to collect a few bucks in dues means that dubious individuals can try to buy their way in to various aspects of party operations where they can do harm. If there is a hierarchy, the wrong kind of people, those who are acting on hidden agendas, can start working their way up it. Now, if nothing else, they can always theatrically, quote-unquote, resign from the National Front if they get their noses out of joint, and they can generate space madness on the internet and in the media before going on the talk show circuit for the SPLC. I won't go into details, but we've already had a couple of episodes where this policy of not having anything to resign from has borne fruit. The best way to prevent this kind of setup is for there to be no formal membership status for anyone to abuse in any way. One doesn't need to be a member of something to do good for the 14 words. Now, the Northwest Volunteers, when they come into being, will be a different kettle of fish, but the time for discussing them is way on down the pike as yet. The Volunteers are nowhere near on the horizon. Now, this gets back to the issue of raising money. And the fact is that the NF is left with those two basic techniques I mentioned a while ago. The first, of selling stuff, and secondly, direct donation, including donation in kind. Like when that rich man steps forward and voluntarily gives me a lease on a building somewhere here in the Pacific Northwest for $1 a year. Oh yes, he's out there too, along with the young man who will be our national organizer. It's just that, like that young man, none of you have found the rich man who will help us yet, and shoved NorthwestFront.org under his nose and made him go to the website so he knows we're here. Any chance you guys could speed up your end of that a bit? We're running out of time here. Right, since we're doing country music this week, here's a song I made reference to in A Distant Thunder. I remember the morning of October 22nd, when Shane is coming home from what will turn out to be his last shift in the warehouse at Mighty Mart, and he finds the Wingfield house in Dundee empty, because the Coeur d'Alene uprising has just begun. But before he arrives, he's listening to this song on the local country station in his car, and he decides he's going to ask Rooney to marry him, and they can become long-haul truckers together. Kind of the last little bit of so-called normality in these young people's lives before history intervenes. Anyway, this is that song from John Conley.
I can remember us cruising through town in your daddy's car with the top pulled down, looking so cool. We came from different sides of the track, but we still held hands out back of the old school. We spent all our time together, laughing and having fun. We swore that we'd love forever, 'cause that was the way things were done at the old. Both made it to our graduation. You chose a college, I chose a vocation, driving 18-wheel. I became a part of your past. You went and married some guy in your class. He was a big deal. Your picture was in all the papers. You made such a lovely bride. They said you were going places, but me, I just went for a ride down by the old school. Could have one dance for the old times. We're slow dancing across the old gym floor. You whisper it could be just like before. Call me sometime. You ask if I understand you. Well, yes, I'm afraid I do. You say everybody does it, but I don't care if they do. I'm from the old school.
Okay, looks like I've done it again and I've run long, so I'll make my closing babble short and to the point. I mentioned earlier in the podcast that I've been known to commit the ultimate perversion of thought in that I listen to Rush Limbaugh sometimes in the morning. And ever since the alleged re-election of the dictator back in November through massive vote fraud, which, needless to say, Limbaugh doesn't mention because the Republicans don't have the stones to raise a stink about it, Anyway, ever since the so-called re-election, he's been talking on his show about how he's finally starting to realize it's a cultural thing, and the Republican establishment really did make a mistake in allowing the liberal Democrats to seize control of the educational establishment and the media 50 years ago. Golly gee, Sergeant Carter, how could they have been so dumb? In other words, this idiot Limbaugh, at age 61, finally seems to be grasping the fact that the America he grew up in no longer exists and has been replaced by Homer Simpson and South Park. His solution is amazingly similar to some of the plans put forth by certain people in our own movement. We've got to, quote-unquote, learn to play the long game and eventually take the country back through some long, slow process of education, wherein young white people are actually taught things in school instead of politically correct horseshit and deviant sexual techniques. Now, how exactly the Republicans are going to seize back the country's educational system from the liberal Democratic NEA, Limbaugh doesn't say. Rush just doesn't seem to get it that it's no longer the 11th hour. On November the 6th, 2012, the clock struck midnight. America's over. Well, lots of luck with that, Rush, but for the record, no. White people are now outnumbered, have been, ever since November the 6th, even if the actual census statistics haven't caught up with the fact yet. But we're outnumbered where it counts, at the polls, by the black, brown, and dumbass coalition. We no longer have the option of playing any kind of long game with these sons of bitches. That ship has sailed. Now, we could still conceivably play the short game with them, if, through some miracle, we could recover our courage and our character. The dictatorship is afraid of exactly that, which is why they're coming for our guns in a few weeks. At some point during the next 4 years, each of us will face his or her own personal decision time, the point where a human being must decide whether to bow down to a tyrant and take his kicks and his spittle and smile in his face, or to stand up and resist. A lot of people down through the ages, the world over, have had to make that choice. Now we have to make it. No, I mean for real. What are you really going to do when you see the blue and red LED lights flashing in your driveway and you hear the bullhorn telling you to exit the building quietly? They've come to execute the mandatory gun buyback, or whatever Feinstein and Schumer decide to call it, and remove your weapons in exchange for a $200 Amazon gift certificate. That's what a semi-auto's going for in Seattle right now, $200 Amazon gift certificate, $100 for a handgun, or whatever Obama simply decrees by executive order. What are you going to do when those lights flash in your driveway? Really? You might want to start thinking about that. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.